Headline, American Marines capture Hong Sung in Korea. Details at 10 tonight. The WBBMR Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.
Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of Vice President Barkley, Senator Robert A. Taft, Governor Thomas E. Dewey, Herbert Hoover, William Green, Governor Earl Warren, Michael DeSalle, Vladimir Clementis, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 12th performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
If this resolution should be adopted, it would be taken in every capital of the world as a signal that the United States of America had hauled down its flag.
He told me that he knew all of the important people in Washington and was on a first-name basis with many of them. During this conversation, he kept repeating the phrase, "That ain't whiskey talking."
Price controls? What price controls? You'd never know we had any if you'd paid the prices I just paid. Did Mike DeSalle ever get to Washington?
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for ear based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were spoken in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. It is broadcast in the hope that the collection of these scraps of sound into a weekly recorded history may add another dimension to our understanding of the news. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
Except for Sunday, when the gavels rested in their boxes and the senators and the witnesses rested and waited for Monday, the Klieg lights were installed. The last 7 days belonged to the congressional hearings. Hearings on troops to Europe, the natural royal pastel minx, the wintry owl, and heavy water deep in Carolina. And do senators or generals win wars? The Republicans were through with their Lincoln Day circuits, which started early and ran past Washington's birthday. And the Democrats were rushing the Jackson-Jefferson Day season.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the Vice President of the United States.
With Vice President Barkley going out to Topeka, Kansas, like a ball player going to early spring training to warm up and see if he still had his stuff.
Mr. Chairman, Georgia niece Clark, ladies and gentlemen, I am deeply grateful to the committee for the invitation that brings me here to participate in this George Washington nonpartisan Democratic meeting. I shall try not to emulate the example of some of our opponents who on Lincoln's birthday, only a few days ago, took occasion to say very little about Lincoln and a lot about us.
And the Veep went on to say,
one of the greatest tasks that the Democratic Party labors under today is to unify the Republican Party.
The Republican Party had known more united hours, but it had seldom known a moment when its members were acting with more independence. This week, the key Republicans passed in review as witnesses on the great debate in Washington. And whether it was the Taft-Hoover-Wherry wing that was right, or the Dewey-Stassen-Lodge wing, it was obvious that they were all more interested in the issue than they were in each other. Governor Dewey, making his initial appearance at a congressional hearing, was one of the first big-name Republicans to testify. Listen to him now, as he tells the Republican Senate leader, Kenneth Wherry, that he doesn't approve or even understand the Wherry resolution to limit the president's power to send troops to Europe. Wherry asks Dewey,
are you opposed to the resolution?
Yes.
On what ground?
On the ground that the resolution has become a symbol.
Oh, a symbol.
It has become a symbol of opposition to the sending of troops to Europe.
But you did not quarrel with the terms of the resolution.
Well, I said I didn't understand it. I read
it. Well, it's 4.5 lines. You said you'd studied it. You're one of the great legal brains of the country.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. We want to give you all the tributes we can. I'd like to know where you can take out of that resolution anything that says that we shall not send troops to Europe unless Congress determines the policy. Where does it tie the hand?
And then Governor Dewey told the committee why he was against the resolution.
If this resolution should be adopted, it would be taken in every capital of the world, both free and slave, as a signal that the United States of America had hauled down its flag. The other nations of the world would little understand or care to inquire about the political differences which might have caused the adoption of the resolution or the constitutional questions involved. It would be understood to be a formal adoption by the Senate of the United States of the theory that the rest of the world was either indefensible or not worth defending, and that we had retreated into Fortress America.
Senator Wherry, who has cross-examined all of the witnesses and produced a few himself, was also a witness this week. Said he wasn't necessarily against sending troops, just wanted to leave it up to the Congress. Senator Wherry went on to say that too many of the witnesses were administration witnesses, and that Generals Bradley and Collins were outmoded strategists, unaware of the age of air power.
Our preparedness effort is being strangled by antiquated, exploded theories of ground war advocates in the Pentagon. General Bradley, General Collins, and others who dominate the preparedness planning in the Pentagon seem to be utterly obvious to the victory potentialities of air power should war come. They seem to be saturated by the idea that war with Russia can be won only by the strategy in vogue before the event of the war play.
The senator, remembering that he campaigned for Dewey in 1948, and with an eye to sturdier presidential timber for 1952, did not take time to criticize any of General Eisenhower's testimony. But there was even disagreement between Wherry and Senator Taft, also appearing as a witness, who said he agreed with Bradley and Collins.
I fully agree with General Collins, who told this committee that it was impossible to separate truly military elements from the economic, political, and psychological elements. General Collins said again that this was not a military decision, and the military should not make it. An examination of General Eisenhower's speeches and of the testimony of the administration witnesses before this committee shows clearly that we have no definite commitment from any foreign nation as to the number of troops it will supply to the international army, which now has so many generals. We hear a constant drumming on the importance of upholding European morale, but nobody seems to be concerned about American morale, which is pretty low now and can be a lot lower.
Herbert Hoover, whose November speech opened the great debate, interrupted a Florida vacation to come up to testify. The former president, still opposed to sending any army to Europe, said that Europeans feared war much more than they did communism and might be willing to accept communism rather than fight. Mr. Hoover on Tuesday.
Many non-communist persons on the continent have a great dread of racial destruction. They fear that their peoples will be further bled white, that their homes and cities again destroyed, and they would prefer an unopposed Soviet occupation to seeing their homelands again becoming a European battlefield.
Another Republican testified in the great debate this week. Although not invited to be a witness by either side, he was ill with the flu and couldn't have made the trip anyhow. California's Governor Earl Warren said that he was against the Wherry resolution and favored military aid to Europe. From the governor's mansion in Sacramento, Earl Warren on the defense of Europe.
I can think of few things that would give Stalin more comfort than to know the United States could not send a division or other unit of its forces to any point of necessity without debating it in Congress and having it there determined. I think the military branch of our government, after the objective has been defined, must be trusted to deploy our troops and use the various arms of the service in the most effective manner. I do not see how we can make those decisions as a matter of political judgment and still have them be realistic decisions. To attempt to do so would, in my opinion, be like tying our right hand behind us and offering to do battle with our left hand alone.
Vice President Barkley was jesting when he said the biggest job of the Democrats was to unify the Republican Party. But there was a considerable domestic problem left unattended in his own party. The Truman administration had a new scar on its soft underbelly. Once again, the president's friends had let him down. The RFC, once the pride of the New Deal and the Fair Deal, was now under a cold, hard light. And one of the president's fellow Democrats, Senator Fulbright of Arkansas, had turned on the light. Last week, the nation heard how a former Reconstruction Finance Corporation investigator, E. Merrill Young, had offered to push through a big government loan in return for a large personal loan. Mr. Young denied this. The man who accused him was Ross Bohannon, a big oil lawyer from Texas. This week, John B. Skiles told the committee that Bohannon was quite an operator himself, knew all the Washington crowd by their first names. The Skiles testimony, the Bohannon story, Merrill Young's denials, and an accidental explosion of a photographer's flash bulb was a shock, even for the seasoned senators Toby and Fulbright. Listen to that brief testimony now. Witness Skiles, the exploding flash bulb, and the last voice is that of Republican Toby of New Hampshire, never at a loss for a quotation.
I met Ross Bohannon at a cocktail party in or around Christmas 1948 in the office of T.M. Rucker, a lifelong friend of mine. Bohannon was introduced to me as a Fair Deal Democrat, and I gathered in the course of approximately 1 hour at this party that Mr. Bohannon was, by his own admission, a man of great influence. He told me that he knew all of the important people in Washington and was on a first-name basis with many of them. During this conversation, he kept repeating the phrase, "That ain't whiskey talking." This meeting took place a long time ago, and I don't remember all of the details, but I do remember that Bohannon told me he had heard from Rucker that I was a real Democrat, and that I knew some people in Washington. I admitted that I had voted for Truman and Barkley, and that I did know a few people in Washington. Bohannon then started telling me about the application he was handling for Tex-Mex loans, and about how much merit the application had. He again repeated the statement, "That ain't whiskey talking."
When did you write that statement?
I stayed home from Sunday school a week before yesterday and spent the entire morning typing it out, hunt and peck, on an old beat-up Underwood typewriter.
Did you have any notes to refresh your memory?
Yes, sir, I did. I had voluminous notes, which I have right here.
Would you mind giving those notes to our staff for their information?
Well, I have no notes.
That ain't
On Tuesday, the spotlight was off Bohannon and back on E. Merrill Young, who, according to one witness, bought an $8,500 natural royal pastel mink coat for his wife, a White House secretary. And the witness was Louis G. Wheeler of New York's Swank Gunther Jackal Company that sells natural royal pastel mink. The firm had applied for a loan.
Will you tell the committee all that you know about the purchase of a fur coat in September by Mr. Young?
Shortly prior to September 15th, I got a call from Frank Rosenbaum saying that he was sending in a friend of his, Mr. Merrill Young, who wanted to purchase a fur coat. Several days later, Mr. Young came in with Mrs. Young and purchased a fur coat.
What kind of a fur coat was it?
Natural royal pastel mink.
Well, is this one of your better fur coats, you said? How much did it cost?
$8,540, including the tax.
Did you give any discount?
Yes, sir, 10%. When people are referred to us through, in this case, it was our attorneys at that time.
And Mr. Rosenbaum, your attorney?
He was at that time, yes, sir.
Did he file an RFC application, an RFC loan? For how much?
For $175,000.
Was it approved?
Yes, sir.
How much did you pay Mr. Rosenbaum for obtaining that approval?
As near as I can call, around Just below $5,000, I believe.
It is necessary to add that the $175,000 loan, although approved, was never actually made. As the day's hearings neared its end, it appeared obvious that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which had financed so many of the war industries and which had been a decided asset to the nation, was in dire jeopardy of losing its strength and perhaps even its life. Senator Tobey said this.
It makes one of us at least feel that what he's felt right along is that the best thing could happen to this country would be the demise of the RFC in toto, get rid of it. It's been an abortion and a miscarriage of the intent of the RFC all along the line. Become a political trading bureau through innuendos and slurs and all. Men trying to build themselves up and pull them up their bootstraps and political influence and all in high places. And it's a pretty sordid picture. If the average taxpayer sees it as some of us do up here, he's going to cry out unclean, unclean, and turn thumbs down and give them the coup de grace. That's what they need, my judgment.
But all the weird hearings and the dervish debates were not limited to American politicians. England had a rhubarb all its own. Last week, Winston Churchill's oral artillery blasted away at Prime Minister Attlee for agreeing that an American admiral should command the Atlantic Pact fleet.